Support for 51% comes from the Master of Arts in Teaching program at Bard College, offering master's degrees and teacher certification in 1 year, graduate study and extensive public school residencies combined with small class sizes, and a focus on the learner as an individual. Now accepting applications, Teaching What Matters, bard.edu/mat/ny.
On this week's 51%, we take a look back to earlier in 2016 at the First Lady, a legacy wall, and an airbrush-free magazine.
Photograph women as they really are and not in an aesthetically predetermined way.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
No matter what the future brings, as time goes by,
first, we have a snapshot look into the early life of outgoing First Lady Michelle Obama. We hear this from the perspective of Peter Slevin, former Washington Post bureau chief and author of the biography, Michelle Obama, A Life.
I was particularly struck by the way she told stories, told her story. She had a remarkable ability to connect with her audiences. I realized that I wanted to tell her story and to tell it against the history that she lived, which meant starting with Chicago. I'm Peter Slevin. I wrote Michelle Obama, A Life.
Too often, we hear a skewed story about our communities. A narrative that says that a stable, hardworking family in a neighborhood like Woodlawn or Chatham or Bronzeville is somehow remarkable. That a young person who graduates from high school and goes to college is a beat-the-odds kind of hero. And I'm here tonight because I want people across this country to know that story, the real story of the South Side. The story of that quiet majority of good folks, families like mine, who face real challenges but make good choices every single day.
Michelle likes to say that everything she is, everything she became, started in the bungalow where they live, where the Robinsons lived on the top floor when she was growing up in the 1960s and 70s.
The family made a point of sitting down to dinner together every evening. Aunt Robbie gave piano lessons to the children. Frazier made time when he returned from work to play sports with the kids. He gave Craig a pair of boxing gloves and taught him how to use them. Craig remembers boxing with Michelle, who told the International Olympic Committee in Copenhagen that her father taught her how to throw a ball and a mean right hook better than any boy in the neighborhood.
I think one of the reasons that Michelle connects with so many people and that her story resonates with so many people is that it's familiar.
The Brady Bunch was a particular favorite of Michelle's, and she developed an encyclopedic knowledge of the show. The family typically devoted Saturday nights to games, Chinese checkers, Monopoly, a bluffing game called Hands Down, and later epic Scrabble battles. From an early age, Michelle hated to lose.
As she has said in introducing herself in 2007 as part of what could be the first African-American couple in the White House, our story is not that unusual. You just haven't seen it before. You haven't seen us before.
Look, I can't tell you how many times people have met my mother and asked her, well, how on earth did you ever raise kids like Michelle and Craig in a place like South Shore? And my mom looks at these folks like they're crazy. And she says, Michelle and Craig are nothing special. There are millions of Craigs and Michelles out there. And I did the same thing that all those other parents did. She says, I loved them, I believed in them, and I didn't take any nonsense from them.
What struck me the most was the way Michelle Obama's upbringing, the lessons she learned along the way, the people with whom she connected became such a strong part of what she's doing now. So much of what she's doing connects with issues of race and class that have been part of her life since she was a girl.
They will make assumptions about who they think you are based on their limited notion of the world.
husband and I know how frustrating that experience can be. The folks who crossed the street in fear of their safety, the clerks who kept a close eye on us at all those department stores, the people at formal events who assumed we were the help.
Virtually overnight, Michelle had become one of the most prominent women in America. The screen was blank, and she was free, if you could call it that, to define a role for herself. Yet she soon discovered that her freedom was defined by a tangle of often conflicting expectations and options.
But as potentially the first African-American First Lady, I was also the focus of another set of questions and speculations, conversations sometimes rooted in the fears and misperceptions of others. Was I too loud or too angry or too emasculated? Or was I too soft? Too much of a mom, not enough of a career woman.
No one who looked like Michelle Obama had ever occupied the White House. No one who acted quite like her either. She ran obstacle courses, she danced the Dougie, she hula-hooped on the White House lawn. She opened the executive mansion to fresh faces and voices and took her show on the road. Her projects and messages reflected a hard-won determination to help the working class and the disadvantaged, to unstack the deck.
I was born and raised here on the South Side in South Shore, and I am who I am today because of this community. I've visited communities just like this one all across the country. Communities that face plenty of challenges and crises, but where folks have that same strong work ethic, those same good values, those same big dreams for their kids. But unfortunately, all those positive things hardly ever make the evening news.
It's a challenge to write about someone as public as Michelle Obama is. One thing about people who have reached the pinnacle is we think we know their story because we know what's been presented to us. One of the challenges of writing this book was to figure out, in fact, what we don't know, and also to figure out what we could learn about why she is doing the things she's doing. That was a portrait that was possible to draw. It's a little bit like a pointillist painting where you have a million little dots. And if you look at it very closely, they're just a million little dots of different shades. But if you step back, a picture emerges. I'm Peter Slevin. I wrote Michelle Obama, A Life.
We now head to Springfield, Illinois, where a legacy wall debuted early in the year. The first of its kind exhibit tells the history of LGBTQ people. That acronym stands for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer. The man behind the project has made an effort to ensure that lesbians especially don't go without recognition. According to some experts, that's a problem when it comes to LGBTQ representation in mainstream culture. Rachel Otwell tells us more.
I'm standing in the Illinois State Library, just a stone's throw away from the State House in Springfield. Two people are putting up information about gay and lesbian figures. They're attaching posters with Velcro to a large freestanding wall. The installation features pictures and bios of leaders in the worlds of politics, art, and science, ones whose sexuality either went unmentioned or made them unmentionable.
Or when in doubt, I always put a woman up instead of a man because history is so male dominant.
That's Victor Salvo, the man behind the project. He's directing volunteer Jen Zayas. He's telling her how he wants to make sure women are featured prominently on the wall. Zayas says she's taken time out of her career as a graphic designer and singer in Chicago to work on the project because she's an ally for her many LGBTQ friends.
It's really important to me. They have a representation in culture and in history that has been well researched and is accurate because many LGBT people have been basically redacted from all history, their contributions. And so when Victor started doing this, so much of this stuff, most of this stuff, I had no idea. I knew some of the people like Sally Ride, Lorraine Hansberry, I knew who they were, I knew what they, but I had no idea they were in the LGBT community.
Salvo says this is part of the reason he started what's called the Legacy Project.
For the Legacy Project in general, the actual idea came to pass over 28 years ago at the National March on Washington for Gay and Lesbian Civil Rights in 1987. A variety of things happened at that time that really got us all thinking about our place in history and our role in history and the fact that we knew nothing about people like ourselves. And it started us contemplating what would actually be required to create a project that would make this history accessible for people who were too afraid to go to libraries to look up the titles.
One of Salvo's previous efforts put up permanent plaques about gay figures along Halsted Street in the heart of Chicago's Boys Town. The new wall is portable, so it can travel to schools and show LGBTQ students positive examples of people like themselves. Growing up, Salvo says his sexual orientation made him feel isolated and depressed. He even had numerous suicide attempts. His decision to include many women is one that Heather Dell greatly appreciates. She's a lesbian and has taught women in gender studies for 3 decades and now works at the University of Illinois in Springfield.
I think it's enormously important. Although gay men are still at tremendous risk of violence in our society, I don't want to minimize that at all. But sometimes lesbians or queer women don't get the coverage that they could use, or they get taken as seriously for all of the work that they've done in the movement. Lesbians were huge in the AIDS movement, although we weren't as at risk nearly. We still don't have women in a lot of leadership positions, or leadership positions held by people who take lesbians as seriously as they could.
Dell says it's crucial to continue work that counterbalances the mainstream narrative of our history, which sometimes ostracizes gay people, and to make sure lesbians are given the same amount of recognition as men. This issue is one that writer Frank Rich recently explored with an article in New York Magazine about how lesbians have gone largely invisible in pop culture.
If he can't have me, I can't see my daughter.
What you're hearing is a trailer for the movie Carol. It was released last year and is based on a novel published in 1952 and authored by lesbian Patricia Highsmith. That novel is called The Price of Salt. Rich says many of the lesbians he talked to for the article say the book gave them examples of two women they could finally relate to. He writes, back then, and even in some ways today, quote, gay women often had to settle for the crumbs of mainstream culture. He says the book was notable for its happy ending. Other novels that mention lesbians at that time painted them as deranged and incapable of success.
This book, which didn't in any way present female homosexuality as pathological, really hit a chord with readers. And when it was published in paperback, it sold nearly 1 million copies.
Rich himself has worked on bringing female leads to the forefront. He's an executive producer for the television show Veep. It features Julia Louis-Dreyfus playing a character who is vice president and then eventually gets the top job. He says Hollywood has been slow to warm up to movies like Carol.
Lesbian culture has suffered in general, as female culture has, in places like Hollywood, because the city is essentially run by men, and some of them are straight men and some of them are gay men. They're all likely to favor their own stories over women's stories, whether the women are straight or gay.
Rich was the chief drama critic for the New York Times for several years, beginning in 1980. He says even there, for a time, he couldn't use the word gay in print. The history of discrimination against gay men and lesbians alike may seem foreign to some teenagers, but for those who live in certain areas of the country, they know all too well that being gay is still not seen as okay. That's the most important audience, Salvo says, there is for the Legacy Wall. Its first stop at a school is at Chicago State University. But he hopes it will travel to schools in neighboring states like Indiana and Kentucky, and then farther across the country. Salvo says many of the gay, bisexual, or transgender women depicted will have familiar names, like astronaut Sally Ride. But the project will delve into aspects of their lives that have been buried.
Somebody like Josephine Baker, who could easily just be regarded as the chanteuse from the Harlem Renaissance era, but then went on to help the French resistance under the Nazis during World War II and then became a civil rights icon.
He says his efforts over the past years have shown him the importance of intersectionality, a term you hear a lot in the feminist movement. It's about the ways our identities interplay and affect each other.
Every gender, every race, every class, every nationality, every religious faith, every orientation, every identity, every variation on the human genome that there is an LGBTQ component to it.
And it's no secret that for lesbians, the intersection of their identities as both gay and female can come with added burdens.
Men, gay or straight, are still men, and there's a degree of privilege that has gone along with that, sometimes a minor degree, depending upon the culture, sometimes a major degree.
For those who see it, the legacy wall will make it clear that women are just as important to the LGBT community as men, a message many girls are still in need of hearing today. For 51%, I'm Rachel Otwell.
Enchantress Magazine is a destination for millennial women. It's airbrush-free, and you won't find any beauty tips among the pages. The inaugural issue was launched earlier this year and features New York City's women firefighters. It also contains a Q&A with six accomplished women who discuss the biggest problem facing American millennial women today and, more importantly, how do we start solving it? And there's lots more. Chloe Kent is the magazine's writer and editor-in-chief. I asked her the genesis of Enchantress.
As an entertainment writer, I was and am bothered by a lot of the ways stories were being told. I wasn't into gotcha journalism. I wasn't into sensationalizing really trivial details about a famous person's life. And so even in journalism school, I started daydreaming about the publication I really wanted to create as a direct reaction to that. And I started by ripping apart all of the things I was taught about magazines that I didn't like. I mean, as a result, you know, we've taken away airbrushing and, you know, Enchantress has nothing to do with fashion or beauty or celebrities or fitness, even though it is a women's magazine. And instead, we feature amazing women, none of whom are celebrities, and amazing stories on our cover, none of which involve cover lines like 12 exercises to lose your muffin top or something. You know, we don't even do cover lines. Instead, we do things that are more inspirational than aspirational.
What has been the response?
So the firefighters were, I hope, happy with the way that the cover story turned out. And we got a lot of really inspiring messages from our readers on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram saying how they'd never imagined that a women's magazine could feel like that.
I have to say, when you hear the word Enchantress, this is not the magazine you think you're going to get.
Right. I mean, I guess in the sense that it's not a traditional women's magazine and it's not exactly a literary magazine either. It's sort of a hybrid of the two that's targeted towards women and women's issues. But actually what's interesting to me is that the word Enchantress, when we went to trademark it, is mostly used for like lingerie and perfume and stuff. It's very like old school French or something. Yeah, I definitely understand where you're coming from.
So tell me about this airbrush-free universe and in this fire issue.
Sure. So we use Polaroids instead of traditional digital photography because most of what we do is about documenting as opposed to creating a narrative. So in journalism school, I was always taught that when it comes to photography, there are mirrors and there are windows. Mirrors capture moments as they are, and windows sort of reimagine worlds as they could be, as they might be. So my aim with making the magazine entirely Polaroid-based and devoid of any airbrushing is to photograph women as they really are and not in an aesthetically predetermined way, which goes along with the fact that the magazine is entirely nonfiction women's stories from interviews to photo essays, personal essays, graphic memoir. And we wanted to use the women firefighters as our cover women because they represent something so powerful and incredible when you hear just their stories. Most New Yorkers don't even realize that there are now 52 women firefighters in the FDNY out of a roughly 10,800 person force, which is about 0.04%. And so we wanted to depict these women in a way that was at once powerful, but also not too cerebral in its design. There isn't a lot of zhuzh going on, for lack of a better word. It's really, these photos, when you look at the cover, really present these women as they were exactly in that moment with no airbrushing and no elaborate lighting setup or anything like that.
So will you be picky about who advertises with you?
I mean, obviously we need to be because a lot of advertisers don't present their content in a means that would be that would strike our fancy. I mean, I don't think that we would be okay with putting any sort of airbrush photographs in the magazine, even if it was advertised. So it's definitely a different way to think about how to advertise. But obviously, everything that we've done thus far has been really in line with our goal. Everything from branding to who I hire. I mean, we are an all-women team. So everything has been in line so far, my team and I would never veer off course just to bring in more advertisers.
So tell us more about the women firefighters in New York City.
Like I mentioned, there are now 52 women firefighters, and they make up 0.04%. And it's still 0.04%. I mean, it's infinitesimal, even in comparison to almost any other male-dominated industry. So there's actually, I mentioned it in the cover story that I wrote for our first issue, there's actually slightly more billionaires in New York City than there are women firefighters, which is pretty amazing to me considering how diverse the city is as a whole and how diverse most other fire departments across the country are. So even though the FDNY goes back to the 1600s, when firefighters who were volunteering, this was even before the FDNY, would bring just buckets of water to the scene of fires. But the first women firefighters wouldn't be sworn in until 1982, when Brenda Berkman, who's featured in the story, successfully won a class action lawsuit against the city of New York. And in the 34 years that women have been in the FDNY, they've achieved a lot of well-deserved success, but they've also faced just incredible opposition, and they've endured a level of harassment and ostracism that seems almost unthinkable now. There were protests outside City Hall. There were death threats. There were bumper stickers plastered all around the city that said things like, don't send a girl to do a man's job. And that was just the public, let alone everything that went on inside the firehouses. So fortunately, it does seem like the FDNY is making a lot of changes in terms of how people are hired and recruited. I think that ultimately the history of these women really got swept under the rug. And so that's why I really, really wanted to cover this story and why it took me so long to do so. I kind of just spent between 6 months and a year on this story, going all over New York City, just looking to get a grasp on what it was like to start out in those early years and what it's like to be a woman firefighter in the FDNY now. I think before, the women had been hesitant to speak about their experiences publicly because they were afraid of inviting harassment or discouraging future classes of women from entering the department. But it was an incredible experience to speak to these women firefighters. I mean, and then not only that, but to go visit them at their firehouse. I went to a training camp with them on Randall's Island for a day. And the whole experience, it was incredible. I mean, I'm so lucky that that I'm able to do things like that because of long-form journalism.
Apart from the low numbers you mentioned, what really sticks with you from covering this story? What's fresh in your mind?
I think for me personally, there's one quote that stands out for me, and that's from Brenda Berkman, who is incredible. I mean, she has her own, like, Makers episode, and she's the subject of a documentary, PBS documentary that's narrated by Susan Sarandon, and she's incredible. And she said, I've been like sort of intimidated by her, and I sat down with her and I asked her point blank why it was so difficult for so many years for you to do this. Why did you keep going? And she said, I'm paraphrasing, I'm going to butcher this quote. She said, all throughout my life, I've been told that I couldn't do the things I wanted to do because I was female. I was told that I couldn't play baseball because girls played softball. I was told that I couldn't take higher level math classes because girls should study English. I was told that girls couldn't run for student council president. And by the time that I got to the FDNY, I thought there's no way I'm letting anyone stop me from doing this just because I'm female. And that really stuck with me.
That was Chloe Kent, writer and editor-in-chief of Enchantress magazine, The first issue, Fire, can be found at enchantressmag.com. If you have a favorite 51% story from 2016, let us know. You can tweet us at 51% Radio. Even better, have a listen. All our shows are online at WAMC.org and via podcast. Just sign up. Go to WAMCpodcast.org. And that's our show this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Chartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. And this week's show is number 1431.